thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Yeah, but it's a holiday. Do I have to? This is John. Hi, how are you? It's 108, and we're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue here all the way until 3 o'clock. It's a very weird day because it took, at least for me anyway, Thursday off, Friday off, Saturday off. Sunday we didn't work. Today's Monday, back to work, but it's kind of one of those hybrid days where if you're working, you're not working hard. The markets were... Ryan, the markets only open for half a day, right?
Correct. They finished up. They were up 200 points, so people were buying and selling to begin the day, but then everyone went off, I guess, to go vacation.
Kellyanne Conway's right. The markets love, if not this president, they love this time. The markets are really doing well. I don't know if Hillary were president, would the markets be doing as well, or if a different Republican were president, would the markets be doing well? But the markets are. And I think that's buying a lot of us with angst these days as we watch the president kind of flip out on Twitter. That's buying us a little time, a little like, okay, but even though he seems to be losing his mind, the markets aren't theirs. And so your 401ks and your pension plans and whatever money you're trying to stow away someday seems to be doing pretty well. There's some consolation in that. I also found some consolation on Sunday, reading the newspaper. The New York Times printed out a special section. It was in its entirety with annotations on either margin, the Constitution. And I know you know of it, and you probably know the first sentence in it, and you recognize a few points about it, but you haven't read the whole thing, and you don't know the whole thing. And so I started to read the thing and didn't finish it myself. But I found it was very interesting. I found it was refreshing. The New York Times said that they print it once in a while, I think, maybe when the country could just use a little primer on who we are and what we are as a people. It's quite appropriate on the 4th of July weekend as well to sort of take stock. And so I'm just reading the thing, and I find it's really interesting. We the people of the United... Don't worry, I'm not going to read it all. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure they were better than this, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, which they spelled D-E-F-E-N-C-E, ha ha ha, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. I mean, if you just care to think about it for a minute, you do get a little goosebumpy going, yeah, we weren't always there. These things that we take for granted or that we get outraged when we feel they are infringed upon weren't even there until our founding fathers said, hey, we're going to start a new country. What should it look like? What will it act like? What will it be? And so Article 1, Section 1 is the only one I'm just going to read right now. And it says, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. You know, and I'm reading this yesterday, and I think, well, it didn't say the king has all the power, or the president, or the supreme leader, whatever you want to call him. It's the people. They have two bodies, the Senate and then the House, and then they go through how those will be constructed, and you sort of feel good about it, in principle. I mean, there's the three-fifths clause in there, and you'll feel terrible about humanity when you read that part. And then it goes to the 25th Amendment, which, as I'm reading through this, is trending on Twitter over the weekend. The 25th Amendment, which is how you can get rid of the president if you don't feel he's capable. Maybe he's been shot and he's incapable. Maybe it's something else. But the 25th Amendment speaks to that. A professor of constitutional law I like to talk to is named Dave Schultz. He's a professor of law at the University of Minnesota. And he joins us on WGN Radio to just kind of catch us up on a few things worth noting on the long holiday weekend. Hi, Dave. It's John Williams. How are you?
Okay, I'm doing fine today. How are you folks doing?
Are you at a cookout?
No, I was just weeding my garden.
Well, I appreciate you giving us 10, 15 minutes of your time here.
No problem at all.
You were listening to my little monologue about the Constitution. You're a guy who's dedicated his life to this. What do you think about it, generally speaking, as a document?
As a document, it was a brilliant piece of work in 1787, and it is still brilliant in many ways. And there are times, though, where I have to remind people that it's a document, you know, created in 1787, that's getting a little old. There may be a few things that we may need to tinker with here and there, but I'm always amazed at how when push comes to shove, how the Constitution still works. Before the election, or actually after the election, when so many people were worried about what was going to happen with Donald Trump being elected, I said, there's this amazing thing called the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that has things like separation of powers and checks and balances and the First Amendment. And I said, guess what? Presidents are not kings. Presidents are not like, what was it, you know, Captain Picard on Star Trek, who said, make it so and make it so. That Trump would start to realize or start to confront the realities of our constitutional system. And in his first 6 months, I think that's true. I think he has been stymied in ways, either good and bad, depending on your perspective, because our Constitution makes it hard for people to become dictators.
So is Donald Trump the sort of person that the Founding Fathers anticipated when they wrote this language?
I think it is. I think that they were anticipating somebody who would be either trying to be an all-powerful person, or the phrase they use in the Federalist Papers, which is sort of the definitive gloss on the Constitution, written by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay. They were also worried about what they called factions. In modern language, we would call those special interest groups. And so the framers were worried about special interest groups. They were worried about strong presidents. They were worried about overzealous courts and Congress. In general, they were worried about how any one person or any one institution could try to abuse its power over time, and how there needed to be some, again, checks and balances, separation of powers,
yeah,
ways to prevent somebody or some institution from dominating the political system.
And I suppose it's true, too, that the intentions of this person, you said, abuse the power of the presidency, but it may be that their intention is good. Suppose the president, I mean, I believe this, I suspect you do too, that the president's ban on immigration was not because he wanted to strike out at any people per se, but because he wanted to follow through on a campaign pledge to make America safer. If that's the same way he feels about the integrity of the elections, all evidence to the contrary, he feels that elections are being rigged. People are voting illegally, 3 to 5 million of them. We've got to crack down on this. His intentions are good, but it almost doesn't matter what your intentions are. There's a process, isn't there? And even if you're right, even if you're well-intended, it doesn't mean you get to have your will. And I think we're seeing an extraordinary period of time right now where, boy, hang on to your Constitution, because this is all you got.
No, you're absolutely correct. I was going to say, take us back, you know, in time to an earlier era, for example, an Abraham Lincoln, or let's say a Franklin Roosevelt, people who would, many historians would hold up as what, our greatest presidents. Even then, the people who were, let's say, well-intentioned, the Constitution placed limits on what they could do. And that's important, because I think what our framers were saying is that, I'll put it in my language, efficient governments are also governments that are dangerous and threatening of individual rights. There is a process, a set of rules that have to be followed.
You said efficient governments?
Efficient governments with a capital E can threaten individual liberty. What I mean by efficient, those without checks and balances, those that just let somebody say, again, make it so, make it happen.
Yeah. That's a running joke on this show, David. You know from having listened to me maybe a little when I was on the air in Minnesota, but I like to say when I get to be king someday, my intentions are always good. And the beauty of having a king is he could be very efficient. He could just say, oh, no, we're building the wall, or, oh, no, those people from that country can't come in. That's just the way. Or we are going to start jailing journalists because they're telling lies about me. And a king could pull that off, you know?
Yes, a king could definitely do that, and many of us would cheer because, as you know, for example, right now, just to pick one subject here, what is it? Probably journalists should be happy that used car salespeople exist and members of Congress exist, because people don't like journalists, but they like them a little bit more than used car salespeople or members of Congress. But it doesn't matter, you know, whether we like journalists or not. The fact of the matter is there's a thing called the First Amendment out there that protects freedom of the press. I may not like the fact that my next-door neighbor has opinions contrary to me, but guess what? The beauty of the First Amendment free speech is that he gets to speak his mind, I get to speak my mind, and that's the process. You know, nobody has a monopoly of knowledge. Nobody has a monopoly on truth.
Mm-hmm.
And in a democracy or representative democracy, the idea is that, again, as you were quoting in the beginning, we the people get to make the decision. Now, I, the person, not I, the king, but we, the people, get to make that call.
Dave Schultz is a constitutional law professor on WGN Radio. Well, you don't think that the president himself, though, is doing anything that violates the First Amendment? I mean, he can be unethical or tacky or mean-spirited or juvenile, but he has, I presume, the same rights to retweet a video that has CNN superimposed in a wrestling match where he body slams CNN. That's legal, and we should support his right to do that, right?
He has a First Amendment right to do that, whether or not we think it's a smart idea to do that.
No, I didn't ask that.
That's exactly my point here, is that from a constitutional perspective, he has First Amendment rights that he can exercise.
But when you do go down the path, I'm going to just go back to this in my 2 o'clock hour. I know the president blew up the internet once again over the weekend, but in my own small way, I did too. When I got dozens of likes and comments, and people were talking about the cuckoo Trump brackets that I've been building, moments that gave you pause and you went, like him or hate him. Holy cow, can you believe what he said or tweeted next? We start with the golden escalator ride where he announces his candidacy and rides down the escalator. When I saw that, I thought that was such a bizarre scene that he'll never figure it out. He'll never succeed if that's his idea of entering a press conference to announce his candidacy. Well, I've been wrong about everything since. But we use that as a starting point. We say, okay, give me your craziest Trump moments. And I really decided to start sort of creating this list when he, when we had the Time magazine thing, and it was discovered that some of the Time magazine covers have been faked. But from then, we've got one more bizarre after another. Dave, all of this to get to this point in question, and that is some of the stuff lately looks so unhinged that people are talking about the 25th Amendment. And that is a process by which you would remove a president. And Mike, you're the expert here. Can you kind of tell me a little bit about how the 25th Amendment works and what it means and why it's there?
Well, the 25th Amendment came about, it actually was ratified and became an amendment in 1967. And even though throughout history we know we've had several presidents assassinated or who died in office, William Henry Harrison, we had Abraham Lincoln, we had McKinley, we never had a really clear process at that point regarding, you know, succession or what happens if somebody becomes ill in terms of, you know, who takes over. And during the Eisenhower administration, he had, I think, a couple of heart attacks, incapacitated, nothing really clear regarding, you know, who takes over or what happens like that. And then, of course, you know, we had the Kennedy assassination. And so I say that because the 25th Amendment tries to clarify sort of presidential succession, who takes over, when the president can pass, let's say, authority over to somebody else, if he or someday she, you know, is sick or something. But the clause that everybody is talking about right now is Section 4, which has language that seems, if I could just read part of it,
yeah.
Whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officer of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress may law provide, transmit to the president pro temp of the Senate and Speaker the written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office of acting president. And that seems to have to set up a process here where those closest to the president, if they reach a conclusion and say something's the matter, you know, he's very ill, psychotic, you know, who knows, whatever it is or something like that, that there's a way that the president can be removed,
mm-hmm.
and the vice president can take over.
Okay, so, yeah, I've got my New York Times Constitution in front of me from Sunday's paper. And it says, as you just read, their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. Okay, I got a question about that. Who needs to sign off on that? How does that get started? And doesn't it require the vice president of the Congress, which is Republican? Doesn't it require their consent? So what chance does this have if it's a mental thing as opposed to physical? The president was shot. Dave, respond to that in just a minute. This is WGN. I'm John Williams. Dave Schultz is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Minnesota, a frequent guest on this show, answering questions about how the Constitution works. We're talking about the 25th Amendment, and Dave, you read a little of it to us, and it says that the Congress or somebody has the power to sort of take the president out of office if he's unable to discharge his duties. It's kind of vague, though, isn't it? And how does that work?
Well, it is vague. That's the one clause of the 25th Amendment, the fourth section, that's never been invoked. And it's just not clear, because it says that, you know, executive members, you know, the White House shall make the decision. It's not clear who's supposed to make that decision. They're supposed to transmit it to Congress. It's not exactly sure, you know, how this transmission process occurs. And then there's a clause in there that also says that the president can send a letter to Congress afterwards indicating that he is fit to take his office again. So I just mention this because there is a lot of vagueness. It's never been invoked before, and no one really knows how it works at all. And in the situation here where you have a Republican president, Republican vice president, Republican Congress, I'm just not sure this is a realistic option for people who dislike Donald Trump to have him removed from office.
Well, I'm just going to read that first half of that first sentence again. Whenever the vice president and a majority of, and then it goes on to say other people, but doesn't it require the vice president to sign off on this? If the president were going to be forced out of office because you thought, oh, gee, it's too much for him, he can't handle the stress, he's lashing out at his enemies, real and imagined, so we need to do him and the country a favor. But it doesn't that require the Mike Pence would have to agree to this, right?
Absolutely correct.
Well, he's not going to agree to this. I mean, not yet. All that we've seen right now, people roll their eyes and say, oh, that's bad behavior. But I haven't seen any of the people in positions of power saying that they actually question his mental ability right now. You know what I mean?
I agree. And also, I was going to say, for the 40% of the population who still supports Donald Trump, according to opinion polls, they would agree with you also. They don't see anything in his behavior that would indicate that he needs to be removed from office either.
Suppose, though, there were a group in Congress, a bunch of Democrats, who do want to try and invoke this. Can they petition the Congress, sort of like an impeachment process? That is, you don't have to convict, you don't have to find that he's incompetent, but we just want to bring it up. Do they have an opportunity to at least invoke this 25th Amendment?
Well, they can talk about it. They could encourage people to consider the 25th Amendment. But at the end of the day, it's going to take some action on the part of the Vice President of the United States, and there's no petition process that members of Congress, including Democrats, could use to force this part of the Constitution to be invoked.
Well, and that strikes me as a flaw in the system, in that if the Vice President signs off on it, but it's vague, but the Vice President is on board, it could be debated, right? But he has a conflict of interest here, doesn't he? Because then he gets to be the president. So maybe we shouldn't ask him. We should ask somebody who's a little removed from, you know, the office.
That is possible, but the text of the Constitution is the vice president. And so whether we think it's a good idea or not, at some point the Constitution and its words matter. And I think the framers, drafters of this amendment, were putting some faith in the fact that the vice president would act in the best interest of the country in making these decisions.
And by the way, but this isn't like 1802 we're talking about here. This is 1967, isn't it?
Correct.
Well, I mean, those guys, I presume some of them are still around who drafted this, who knew the intent. I wonder if they were anticipating something like this and what they would want us to do. What do they intend for this 25th Amendment to be used for?
And that's a great question here, because clearly most of it is about physical incapacitation.
Right.
And I suspect even the fourth section is about physical incapacitation. It's not about when you think somebody is crazy or they disagree with you or you don't like what they have to say. Just because you don't like the politics or the views or antics of the President of the United States doesn't give you the right to remove him.
I think that's an enormous point. Last two texts. John, interesting that your guest noted Lincoln. I'm reading a book on Lincoln's war strategy. Lincoln actually violated portions of the Constitution, suspension of writ of habeas corpus, etc. This does happen sometimes where the Constitution doesn't win. And John, my 15-year-old's really interested in the political system. Does your guest recommend a book my son could read to learn more on the Constitution? What do you say to that one?
Well, the first one, in terms of Lincoln, yes, but eventually the courts did come back in terms of responding and putting checks on what the president did. If I were going to pick one single book on the Constitution, there's a great history book called The American Constitution, and a bunch of authors, but the first author is Kelly. It's considered probably the best, I'd say one of the best books on the history of the Constitution from the framers all the way up to the 21st century.
The American Constitution, and one of the authors is named Kelly.
Kelly and Harbinson are the authors.
Kelly and Harbinson. By the way, what's the best book you've ever written?
Boy, it's always a tough one. I actually think my forthcoming constitutional law textbook is pretty good. And so I would put that on the list.
Well, I'm going to talk to you when that comes out. This guy has a lot of interests, and they all aren't just about the Constitution. Dave, it's nice to talk to you. We'll visit again. Thanks for your help this afternoon.
Anytime, John, and hello to Chicago.
That's Dave Schultz. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Minnesota, and he writes about space. We've been paying attention at all to this migration of these Asian carp that are coming up from, well, Asia through central Illinois and hopefully not into the Great Lakes. And all of the Great Lakes states are cognizant of it, and they're diligently trying to keep these fish from swimming upstream. And boy, if they get into Lake Michigan, if they get into Lake Superior, if they populate there, I think life will be different for a lot of people and certainly for a lot of fish. And they have, as I understand it, this electric grid that the fish are not supposed to be getting past. But there was a story last week that one rogue carp did, thinking, okay, that's a fish I want to shake his hand. A fish that can swim upstream and get past an electric grid is a fish on a mission. But I don't know exactly how this works. So we called somebody who does, and that's Charlie Woolley, who is the Midwest Deputy Regional Director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And he joins us now on WGN Radio. Hey, Charlie, it's John Williams. You're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
I'm wonderful, John. Good afternoon to you and all of your listeners.
Is that a fair assessment? I mean, these fish are swimming upstream, and they are not populous or at all in Lake Michigan, are they?
That's correct, John. To date, we have not seen any big or silver carp in Lake Michigan, and we want to keep it that way. And your reference to the Army Corps of Engineers electrical barrier is related to a June 22nd finding that a contract commercial fisherman hired by the Illinois Department of Natural Resources captured a silver carp right below the T.J. O'Brien Lock and Dam, which is about 8 miles south of Lake Michigan. So this is a little concerning and perplexing to all of us. This is about 40 miles upstream of the most recent survey location where we've seen Asian carp in the Illinois waterway system. We're not sure if it swam through the Army Corps of Engineers electrical barrier or how it got to this location by the T.J. O'Brien Lock and Dam, but we're trying to figure that out right now.
What's the deal with these fish? Why do we not like them?
Oh, we're very, very concerned, John, that if they get into the Great Lakes, they would outcompete our native fish and our important commercial fish. They are just voracious eaters. They compete with our native fish for food. Most of our native fish eat plankton during the early part of their life cycle, and that's the same food that the Asian carp are eating throughout their whole life cycle. So we really want to keep them out of the Great Lakes because we know they'll have a devastating impact on the fisheries there.
You know, I don't even think of the Great Lakes anymore as fisheries. I think of them as, you know, I'm at the beach. I see people sailing and swimming and sunning and motorboating. Is that a big deal, the commercial fishing of the Great Lakes?
Both commercial and sport fishing, John. In the Great Lakes on the U.S. side, it's about a $7 billion industry. So when you go from Lake Superior all the way down to Lake Ontario, A lot of people make their living through either providing charter boat operations or commercial fishermen in the Great Lakes today.
I'm glad to hear that the lakes are that healthy. I mean, so they support vast numbers of fish, and it's $1 billion fishing industry, huh?
That is correct, a $7 billion fishing industry.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a remarkable resource. It has come back really from the brinks of some hard times in the late 50s and 60s with water pollution. The states, the federal government have all done their share of helping clean up the Great Lakes, and they're a remarkable natural resource that we should all be very proud of.
Why do I call them Asian carp? You called it silver carp. Are there more than one kind of fish here?
Yes, you're right. Asian carp is a reference term that we use for silver and big head carp that are found in the Illinois waterway system. It's the silver carp that was found close to Lake Michigan on June 22nd, though, that has captured everybody's imagination and is the source of our conversation here today.
Huh. Were they originally from Asia? Why are they in central Illinois?
Yes, they are originally from Asia. And in the 50s and 60s, they were brought into ponds down in the southern part of the United States to help control algae in catfish ponds, aquaculture ponds. And also they were helping improve water quality in sewage treatment ponds down south. There were a number of floods in the 60s. They inadvertently got into the lower Mississippi River. And since the late 60s, early 70s, they've been slowly working their way north towards the Great Lakes, and they're about 40 or 50 miles south of the Great Lakes right now in what's known as the Dresden Island Brandon Road area.
Yeah. So how do you describe this electrical grid? It seems crazy that you wouldn't have electricity and water, and boy, if I were a fish, I would sure swim away from that. What are we talking about here?
That's correct, John. The United States Army Corps of Engineers operates this very sophisticated electrical barrier down in Romeoville, Illinois. It's a series of grids, exactly the way you described it, underwater, that pulses electricity at various strengths to keep fish from moving upstream towards Lake Michigan. The Army Corps of Engineers has spent years perfecting this. It has backup systems associated with it. They're actually in the process of putting in another additional system at Romeoville as we speak right now. And it's built to keep big head and silver and other species of Asian carp from moving up
right.
The Illinois waterway system.
Well, if I were swimming there or skiing near there, how far out does the shock pulse go? Would it affect me?
No, it's contained within a lock-type system down there. And the Army Corps of Engineers has worked very closely with the barge industry and the Coast Guard to have specific regulations in place there so that when a boat or a barge transits that area, there are certain speeds, certain conditions, and certain ways that boat has to move through so that nobody's injured inadvertently by the electricity, yet the electricity still is functioning to keep carp out.
And does it just, like a electric fence for your dog, pulse and it's painful and they go away, or does it kill them?
It's a deterrent. It shocks them and moves them away, just like an electrical fence does for your dog.
How about that?
Yeah, right.
But then we got one of them that's on the other side. Now, I suppose I could have caught one, put it in a cooler of water, and just walked it across, put it in my car, and driven it on the other side, right?
Yeah, that's stranger things have happened. It's always a possibility. That's why this is such a perplexing issue for us, and it's got a certain sense of scientific mystery associated with it. But one thing we are doing, John, is with this 8-pound silver carp that we captured, we're getting some gene sequencing work done with the fish. We're looking very closely at the genetics. We're doing some microchemistry work with the fish. So we're going to study this fish and see if we can understand exactly where it's been, the life cycle of this fish, and answer some of these questions.
These are the ones, though, that videos popped up a few years ago where they were so numerous when water skiers or motorboats go up and down the Illinois River down by Peoria, say at Lake Peoria, they jump and you can shoot them with a bow and arrow.
That is correct. Those are the silver carp. They get agitated by boat motors and the pulsating that comes from a boat motor. And it's a real problem down, as you mentioned, down in the Peoria Pool. And we wouldn't want to see anything like that continue north and get into the Great Lakes and some of our harbors. You know, downtown Chicago, where you have all this great boating and recreation that's occurring there, to have silver carp jumping up and hitting people in the head and knocking people out of boats and injuring them would be just horrible.
Yeah, you know, that sounds like a crazy concern or fear, but literally Google silver or Asian carp Peoria, and you just can't believe it. And these things, they're like 3-4 foot long. What do those suckers weigh?
Yeah, they can get up to 30, 40, 50 pounds. They're just flying little missiles. That
yeah, that's what it is. You can't believe it.
Yeah,
this
absolutely.
Missile
absolutely.
Just shoots out of the water. Okay, but on a phone line, Charlie, we've got a couple of listeners who have not only questions but theories about how they got past that electric grid. Because I got to tell you, if I'm swimming upstream and say I'm a fish and there's electricity this way and not electricity that way, I'm going to go that way. What compels the fish to go forward? How does that happen? Okay, a couple theories about that. You have a question, 2312-981-7200 on WGN. I'm John Williams. I don't fish much, although a friend of mine sent me a picture of me with a fish that I caught last year. That is one unlucky fish, but thank you for that. But I know a lot of you are into angling, and as our guest said a moment ago, even if you're not, if the idea that you would be water skiing or zipping up and down Lake Michigan meant that Asian carp would be jumping up and going after you, well, now suddenly you do care or are interested. You know what we need to do, Charlie, though? Charlie Woolley's on the phone line. He's the Midwest Deputy Regional Director with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We need to develop an appetite for these things. I mean, maybe, what if everybody saw those things as walleye or fillets, you know?
Right, right. That has been tried, John, in a number of locations in the Midwest, and there's a limited market for bighead and silver carp right now. I know that there have been some entrepreneurs that have been trying to expand that market, but that's a possibility, and certainly people are working at that right now.
And even if we all did love Asian carp or found a, you know, reason to eat them, the way you put it, they eat the plankton that the other fish eat, and they eat it their whole life, so it would just kill off the walleye or whatever else we got in Lake Michigan, right?
That is correct. That's the biggest concern that we have, John, is that the Asian carp get in and they just start to outcompete the native fish that we have. They're no known predators for Asian carp here in the United States, and it would just be a shame to see anything happen in the Great Lakes. And really what they've done is they've left a trail of destruction as they've moved up the Mississippi River. We know that that's what would happen in the Great Lakes, and we just want to avoid that at all costs.
Well, you know, you hate to see us mess with nature. You go, I got a good idea. Let's introduce a species that's not native to an area. I think milfoil was brought into parts of this country with good intentions, and look what milfoil does, you know?
Yes, milfoil. You can look at house sparrows, a number of species like that. You just want to respect Mother Nature and not necessarily try to mess with her.
Jimmy had an observation, though. Hey, Jimmy, this is John, and you're on WGN. What did you want to say?
My question is this. When the Asian carp spawn and they lay their eggs,
yeah,
can those eggs become attached to the feathers of a duck's or other waterfowls? The ducks fly upstream 4-6 miles, go back in the water, and with those eggs detached, and then the carp will be born.
How about
that's
that
my
one?
Only question.
Yes, great, great question. We spent about 3 years ago field season looking at that and found that they just will not attach. There isn't anything sticky enough on an Asian carp egg for it to attach to a duck or a heron or anything like that to move it upstream. But if you know, we thought that was a possibility. We spent a lot of money looking into it. Just doesn't seem like it's practical. So probably not a threat to us right now.
Really interesting question, Jimmy. I like your thinking out of the box there. How many fish would you need to get upstream? Like maybe one or two do, but you need how many for it to actually become a viable population?
John, we figure that you would probably need hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of fish to get upstream to turn into a viable population, because you'd have to have a number of different generations for a fish like this to become established in an area. So it would take a while, but if we don't do anything to control these fish moving north, it's certainly a possibility.
Al, you're on WGN. What did you want to say? Hi.
Hi. Well, thanks for taking the call. You know, I know from the history of the Midwest that we have been very successful in wiping out many different species of fish, fowl, other types of wildlife. So how come we can't be successful in wiping these guys out?
Yeah, right. Yeah, somewhere there's a passenger pigeon going, really? You're kidding me. You can't kill these things? Hello?
Well, the Illinois DNR is really doing a great job right now with contract commercial fishermen. So fishermen that are used to catching these kind of fish in big river systems, the state is paying them right now to go out and fish these numbers down, particularly down in the Marcellus Pool and the Dresden Island Pool, you know, the south of Chicago. So we are looking at experts like the commercial fishermen, getting them on our side, contracting with them to go out and remove millions and millions of pounds of these fish. And I think that's going to help, but it'll be one tool in our toolbox.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for the question. Hey, John, this texter says, we moored our boat at Starved Rock Marina, and these carp would jump with such force out of the water they would knock people off their wave runners. They would even land on the docks. Hey, John, why can't we catch it and use it for cheap bait around the world, just round them up? But I suppose your point about that would be that we just would never be able to keep up, right? In the meantime, they'd be wreaking havoc on other species.
That's correct. We probably don't want to take our problem and send it to another place in the world and make it their problem. So we're very careful about not doing that. So what we want to do, though, is long-term, John, what we're going to have to do is find a chemical control that will be able to kill just silver and bighead carp. Nothing else. We're looking at a potential enzyme that's in their stomach that would activate a chemical that they would ingest that would just kill those fish. So that's a possibility out there on the horizon, and that would be a huge tool to help us control these fish if we get there.
A lot of people are calling in with ideas about how to use the fish, turn them into cat food, feed poor people, whatever. But all of that I'm hearing you say is beside the point. Tom has the last question that I want to get to, and then we'll let you go. We're out of time. Tom, you're on WGN. Hi.
Yeah, why not an electric shock that just gets rid of the Asian carp, just kills them?
Yeah, why are we trying to deter them? Let's zap them for good there, Charlie.
Well, we do with the contract commercial fishing that I just referenced and some of the other work that we do. We do get those fish, kill them, pull them out of the Illinois waterway system, put them in landfills, turn them into fertilizer, cat food, et cetera.
Yeah, so but no, down in Romeoville, in Romeoville. You know, where you've got this electric grid, just took that thing on 11. Boom.
Sure. Right now, the good thing about Romeoville is that the leading edge of Asian carp is still about 30 miles, 40 miles south of the Romeoville barrier. So it's not like we have Asian carp constantly penetrating that barrier, trying to get through. They're still ways down. It's at one or two
so
rogue.
You can do that if you need to.
Yes, if it's possible. But we want to keep these fish far downstream, hence the work with the contract commercial fishermen to thin them down.
And by the way, what about the other fish coming through? They're not crazy about it either, right?
And no, that's the unfortunate thing is that we do have native fish. I know that Illinois DNR would love to see moving through there. Smallmouth bass, walleye are a great example.
Yeah.
Yes.
Out of time. Charlie, well, let's visit again. You know, we'll follow this story and hopefully continue to report good news. Good luck to you all on this, all right?
Thank you, John, and thanks to your listeners for their interest.
Yeah, Charlie Woolley is the Midwest Deputy Regional Director for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
And temperatures.
Here's John Williams.
Thank you, Steve. Kevin. Here you are for your game a little bit there. My apologies.
That's okay. It should have been better.
208 on WGN. I'm John Williams. And
Lord have mercy.
This is pleasant on the outside. If you wanted a really hot day on the 4th or the 3rd of July, we don't have that in store for you today. It's not the 4th yet, but it will be soon, and normally it's much warmer this day of the year. So warm that you might want to go to the beach, but you can't in New Jersey because Chris Christie has the beach all to himself. Chris Cillizza on the front page of CNN today wrote, "That picture is proof that Christie does not care anymore.
He's done.
He is so done. He's out of office in January, and he doesn't care. He does not care."
He tweeted out today something that he said, 119 of the 130 miles of coastline is open. He said, so go to the beach, enjoy it, wear sunscreen, and don't forget to hydrate.
Did he really?
Yeah, that was his tweet.
Was he, boy, you just don't know what the tone of that is supposed to be.
Well, I think
was it sincere or was it like, screw you?
I think it's, a little of both, right? Because it serves a point. The point is that, you know, not all the beaches are closed. It's one park. So that's it.
It's shut down because of a government. You know, go figure. We're not the only state that didn't get a budget passed in time.
Right, exactly. I'm trying to find the exact quote here. Because they went back to another meeting, but
well, did you hear what happened? So then they asked the Star alleged. So the beach is this beach is closed. So then one of the reporters asked if the president, the governor had gotten any sun that day, and they said no.
He said, did not get any sun. You looked like you got some sun today.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I didn't get any sun.
I didn't. He said, according to the Star Ledger, I didn't get any sun today. Not knowing that there were pictures of him with his family at the beach. And not just like strolling, because I thought that would be a thing where the governor goes to the scene and then looks concerned.
Right.
And he's got the rolled up long sleeve khaki look. That's the governor at a hurricane.
The Hurricane Sandy look.
Right. Yeah, so I thought he was going to go there to show a concerned face and represent the people. These beaches need to be open for the citizenry. No, he had flip-flops on.
He was plopped down.
He was plopped down in one of those little low-to-the-ground seats.
And then his spokesman, when presented with the pictures or something, said, well, he did stop by to talk to his family. He had a hat on. He didn't get any sun.
His spokesperson, Brian Murray, recalibrated. Boy, there's a great verb. You don't hear that often.
That's a new GPS term, right?
Recalibrating.
You took a wrong turn.
Chris Christie is recalibrating.
After being told of the existence of the photos of him, as Steve Bertrand said, plopped down on the beach, said, quote, the governor was on the beach briefly. He did not get any sun, however. He had a baseball hat on.
Yeah.
Boy, hey, by the way, if you are in government or if you represent people who are in government, you have to stop lying. You have to stop telling even little fibs. Just stop it. Say, yeah, he was at the beach. And by the way, he doesn't care anymore.
Right.
I mean, that would be. I would respect that. Christie would respect that.
Here's this tweet from about 10 o'clock this morning. And it's a valid point. New Jersey beaches are open in 119 of our 130 miles of coastline. Come and enjoy them, but use sunscreen and hydrate.
As I did when I was getting a little bit of sun earlier today.
2 hours ago, he tweeted, another beautiful day at the Jersey Shore. Our beaches are open and full of people. Come and see for yourself, and you can hit the boardwalk.
Here's, though, where he really is showing his tone. Asked about that, but why were you able to use the closed beach? He said, that's just the way it goes. Run for governor, and you can have a residence there, too.
So there's a house right off that beach state park that the governor uses.
And, you know, so really, wait a minute. The beach is closed, so does that mean it's closed for him or not? I don't know. I don't much care. He doesn't care, so it goes.
Then he was on a TV show in Philadelphia this morning. He said, look, my home in Trenton is available for visitors, too. It's closed because of the shutdown. I can't stay there either. Maybe I should check into a hotel.
Naturally, memes are popping up everywhere. So they've taken out the picture of him with his, are those flip-flops? Yeah, he's got flip-flops on and shorts and a shirt and a hat, which kept him from getting any sun today. And so they've cut that out of that beach scene, and now they've plopped it into Michael Jordan's iconic flying tomahawk dunk, where he's traversing the distance of the lane. Lord, MJ is high up in the air, sailing right over Chris Christie. There's R2-D2. There's some cast characters from Star Wars on one of those endless sandy planets, and there in the background is Chris Christie. There's Burt Lancaster and Deborah Kerr kissing in the surf from Here to Eternity. And next to them, looking away, is Governor Christie sitting in the lawn chair.
I mean, it wasn't just happened by the beach. They were all laid out there. There were like six or seven family members.
That's it.
And
it,
so there had to be, I mean... They had to know.
They had to have a plan. No, we're going to the beach. But, Dad, the beach will be closed. I'm the governor. What are they going to do? Fire me?
Right.
We're here for 6 more months. Let's enjoy the beach.
There's a great picture of the beach from the sky of just a beach area fully packed and populated. And then you get to the state park border, and it's empty. You know, and then
For one little tiny family down there.
Right. He doesn't show up in that picture.
Maybe Donald Trump. Yeah, right. Maybe Donald Trump paid him to do this so as to deflect from his endless deflections from the real issues, his crazy Twitter account. You know, I said that we should do a bracket battle
right.
with 16 teams when the fake Time magazine covers came to light that the president has on some of his properties. Fake Time magazine covers of him, and it says, you know, he's got a hit TV show too, and it was at a lot of his golf resorts, and so that came out, and I said, you know, we just got to do like a bracket. What's the wackest, craziest, cuckooest thing that the president has said or done or tweeted since he became a candidate from the moment he rode down the escalator? And I thought this would be my number one seed, and then lo and behold, a couple of days later, we had the Morning Joe facelift tweet, which was just off the charts. And I don't know what was the most offensive part about that. His trying to out Mika Brzezinski for having a facelift, which she says she hadn't.
She had a chin tuck or something.
Okay. Well, I don't know what a difference between one or the other is. But so she had some cosmetic surgery, and him outing her for that as though that would punish her. Or calling her low IQ. Or, you know, just the fact that it was also unpresidential.
Or Crazy Joe, her fiancé, Joe Scarborough.
And I thought that this was an administration that was on the anti-bullying campaign.
Well, his wife is.
And her defense of this is, if you bully us, then we bully you back 10 times harder. That's the way this president fights for people. Okay. So then I thought, oh, holy cow, forget about the Time magazine. Nothing is going to top the facelift tweet. Then the next day, I wake up, and there is the verified at Real Donald Trump account and the official POTUS account. I mean, the account on Twitter for the presidency of the United States posting the video of Donald Trump body slamming a CNN graphic. The video, I could tell you a little bit about, was made by a Reddit user, it appears. A Reddit user is taking credit for creating that video of President Trump that he posted to Twitter depicting him of punching a physical manifestation of CNN. Time magazine writes, the same user has previously posted several racist, Islamophobic, and anti-Semitic memes on Reddit. It appears to have been submitted... this person appears to have submitted the Trump wrestling GIF 5 days ago to the_Donald subreddit, where people gather to idolize the president and hurl hatred toward Trump's supposed enemies. So there's a place on Reddit where Trump fans go, and this was posted there. Trump takes down fake news, it was titled. It shows him punching the head of Vince McMahon from WWE back in 2007, but they put the CNN graphic on there. And then the president, so he didn't do that. And I could see him seeing that and smiling or chuckling, but that he retweeted it on both accounts is being treated as quite remarkable. And then he posted that with, quote, hashtag fraud news CNN and hashtag FNN. I guess that's the fake news network. So, Steve, now my dilemma is, which of those is my new number one seed for cuckooish things that the president has said, done, or tweeted?
Sometimes you have to take a step back and consider each of these in isolation.
Yeah.
Because now we're used to it.
Right.
But it's like, wait a minute, the White House just tweeted out a video of the president beating up a fake CNN person. That's the White House did that. We live in such... extraordinary times, you know. I think we lose sight of that sometimes.
Well, that's why I distinguish between his verified account and the account for the presidency of the United States. What our government is saying, our presidency is saying, is that we want to punch the biggest news organization in the world out. We want to fight them and body slam them. And either it's literal or it's funny. Hey, it's just a joke. We're beating up the media. They beat on us, we beat on them. Hey, it's funny. It's, you know, if I were to be generous, I would say this is just the president's idea of retweeting a funny thing. It's just a joke. Come on, it's a joke.
Right. And so, yeah, if it's not literal, which I don't think it probably is, still, the White House is tweeting out a little video of the president of the United States beating up a cartoon CNN person.
Official. Okay, but so then, so we have these, so I need 16 teams in my brackets, and what I'm doing...
You got to be like the NCAA. You're going to have to expand the tournament.
We're going to have a play-in date for those marginally good ones that you might want to root for.
Like the four or five that happened before the announcement.
The John Millers of the world, which don't make the cut because, I'm sorry, John Miller, you were really a factor before he announced his candidacy. So John Miller's out. But I've got the escalator ride in there, the jazz combo at the climate announcement where we pulled out of the Paris Accord. The president or his people thought it would be fun to have a little four-piece jazz band loosen up the crowd, and they did. Covfefe has got to be in the top five or six, right? How is Covfefe not in there? The Abe handshake, where the is it president or prime minister of Japan? If prime minister of Japan is, you know, locked hands with the president. When he finally releases, he just goes, whoa, or whatever they say in Japan when they want to say whoa. The fake Time magazine cover, the inauguration crowd controversy. I'll tell you, one of my dark horses is the taco salad Cinco de Mayo picture from a couple of years ago. That was awesome. If something else needs to be in there, you need to call me at 312-981-7200 and tell me what it is. I posted this on Facebook. I'm King John on Facebook and asked you for your contributions, and we got a lot of them. When he left his wife behind on the way to the White House on Inauguration Day, the black stretch SUV pulls up and he gets out. The Obamas are waiting there and he's halfway up the steps. And now here comes Melania. Hello. A lot of us have done that before where you sort of rudely forget that your date or your spouse is there. But Melania was not on his mind when he got out. He saw the prize. The finish line was at the top of those steps. He has always wanted to be on the top of those stairs. And so he made a beeline. And his wife eventually made her way up with the lovely gift. John, don't forget the 2 Corinthians. John, don't forget the letter from his doctor claiming that Donald Trump will be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency.
That was a good one.
That was a good one. If Ivanka weren't my daughter, I'd be dating her.
That was a bad one.
That was... And also, that doesn't count because that was pre-escalator ride, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, was it? Well, I guess we learned about it after, but...
Yeah, as we did John Miller. How about this one? Signing a Make America Great Again hat for a child fan and then throwing it into the crowd. I remember that.
I love that
He's
one.
He's like, here, everybody, yay! The kid's like, where's my hat?
The kid gave him the hat. He's like, oh, yeah, the president signed him a hat, and then... He throws it up, and the kid's like, no!
But, yeah, that's it. The kid had a no!
And then the president did it to another hat.
I know, another guy.
I think he was oblivious in the first one.
Yeah.
He didn't really wasn't thinking of it, but then
These are $20 hats, Mr. President.
It went so well. He's like, well, I'll
You're
do it again.
Selling them on your website. Thomas writes, accepting a veteran's Purple Heart medal, saying, you know, I've always wanted one of these. A veteran gave him his Purple Heart, and the president said, oh, wow, thank you. I've always wanted one of these. Megyn Kelly, she had blood coming out of her. So those are some that need to be in the brackets. It's a 16-team tournament. We're about to seed it. If you have any suggestions, you can text them to 312-981-7200 or call that same number. Patty Vasquez is in Springfield. We're wondering exactly what's happening down there. Patty, welcome to my little show here. How are you?
I'm well. I am actually right now. I've left Springfield for at least the day. I'm in Elkhart, in Illinois, right now. Population 500.
You're on your way back, or are you going to hang out in Elkhart for a while?
I'm hiding. I'm hiding from the madness. there's a bit of a standstill in the Capitol, and I'm coming back to drive in the 4th of July parade in Skokie tomorrow, and then back in Springfield. The House will re-adjourn tomorrow at 4:30 p.m.
Now, Mike Madigan's House, I'm reading a headline here, Steve's been talking about this too, approved major income tax hike as Republicans break with Rauner. So are you talking about that, or are you more just interested in the budget battle?
Well, the budget battle continues because, I mean, and it really is now taken on the public battle, too. I don't know if you saw that one of the Republican representatives has announced that he's stepping down, Representative Chris Hayes.
Yeah.
And in his statement, he said, you know, there's too much going on in the press conferences and not enough legislating kind of thing. And this has really become a battle of what is going to get our state back on track. And there, it really, you know, the biggest argument is really whether or not do we need an income tax increase in order to really right this ship. And that's what several Republicans have decided to cross party lines and align themselves with the Democrats on that. And here's the thing that's interesting is that everyone's saying, oh, well, you know, there's enough votes now. You've got Republicans on board. And I'm hearing rumors that if the governor does veto this entire package, there's a possibility the speaker will not call for an override vote. So it sits in the governor's lap is what I'm hearing.
Hmm. So where is Illinois in terms of not having a balanced budget or having a budget? I mean, it's 2+ years now, right?
Well, I guess we're this would be our third fiscal year because it starts on July 1st. So this is the third July 1st that's come and gone without a budget. And for a lot of people, there are a lot of social services, a lot of agencies, and there are a lot of people that are, you know, make supplies to the state, whether it's goods or services, that are behind, they haven't been paid. Some people have not been paid in 18 months. Some people are $1 million behind. That's the PACT organization, which helps individuals with disabilities. They don't know how much longer they can survive like this, not knowing when a check will come to pay their employees, to take care of people.
Patty, we spent time on this show, probably all of our shows did, talking about the fact that the IDOT said that we're going to pull up the construction projects, or at least we're going to stop them. Did they get emergency funding for that?
I have not heard that there's anybody getting any emergency funding. That's happened the last 2 years where there have been what they called stopgap budgets or bridge budgets or lifelines. And there has been this has been a week where people have said that this is it. We want to do the whole thing. Get it done so that we don't have to, you know, piecemeal this, because that ends up costing us more as well. You know, we're paying $1 billion in interest to borrow money to get through this a year.
Yeah, it's pretty, you know, I don't know that people care, although I think they do. I think Illinoisans do care, not just because it's a matter of civic pride, but because it does begin to affect us. We have to pay, in essence, these higher interest rates. And so that we are at or near junk bond status means that when the state borrows money, they borrow it at a higher interest rate, and you and I have to pay the difference. Instead of 1%, it's 6% or something like that.
Nope.
That's money that we have to make up. What's the matter, Steve?
Just, Patty, you've been talking on Facebook about the Senate. Now, they're looking to see if the Senate will vote today. Are you saying you're not sure that it will?
I've been told. That's why I'm in the car. I was told that, that could change. But even if, I've heard that there aren't enough members present to move the budget package along to the governor's desk. There might be enough members present, but there aren't enough to pass it.
Wait a minute. What do you mean not enough members present? I thought that's what they did. Didn't they all have to go down there and do this stuff?
There are parades to go to.
Seriously, I get it. But, I mean, I'm all for constituency and blah, blah, blah. But I'd rather them be in Springfield.
I only know that I believe that somebody with traveling had meetings that were scheduled for today that couldn't be avoided. I have not heard whether everyone's talking about it. They're all going, as far as I know, they're all planning on skipping their parades, and that's probably, I would imagine, the best. You know, who wants to walk down the middle of the street in the wide open when people are angry? Who knows?
So handicap this for us, then, Patty. What do you think is going to happen the next few days?
Oh, man. You know, I felt a little bit better I'm trying to remember when I felt better. I don't know. It changes every day because every time someone tells me something scary, that scary thing ends up happening.
Like what?
I remember in 2015, Representative Dan Brady told me in April of 2015, he said, I don't think we're going to have a budget this year. And I didn't quite know what that meant. And here we are almost 3 years later. I guess it's 2 years, but it's a third session. Every time someone says that something weird's going to happen, it seems like it happens. And like I said, that the speaker, if the governor vetoes this, and the speaker may not call it, I don't know how long this lasts.
You know, seriously, we're all partisan enough, but I'm not real pro-Democrat or pro-Republican when it comes to state politics. I think we more focus on individual personalities, like I really do or don't like the governor, or I really do or don't like Mike Madigan. And I don't honestly know who to be mad at about this. Like, I'm not smart enough and I haven't spent enough time to figure it out, but I know somebody's screwing up, maybe the whole lot of them, but I don't know most specifically to whom I should direct my ire.
I think you're right. I think both. I think that the speaker is very mysterious and hard to, even though, you know, when they adjourned it today, people seemed very surprised on both sides of the aisle. And the governor has a wall up, and I know that, you know, there are a lot of people who reach out, a lot of legislators who would like to talk to him, and he is not accessible to them. You know, I don't know if he keeps it to just I'll meet with leaders. So I think that there's a lot going on that that makes this impossible for impossible for us to understand, quite frankly. It's frustrating. Everyone's angry. Everyone's frustrated.
I wonder if they're embarrassed. I wonder if Mike Madigan enjoys this sort of mysterious persona he has, the man behind closed doors, the lever puller, all of that jazz, the power player. Because at the end of the day, this is your legacy, Mike Madigan. You're not going to be in office forever. This is your legacy.
Well, and that was the thing, the moment that was weird for me when I asked him about that, when I had the opportunity to interview him and I asked him, I didn't ask him about his legacy. I asked him what he thought his mark in Illinois history would be. And he talked about his legacy being his family. And that's strange to me because he's the longest serving Speaker of the House in the history of the United States, in any state. And, you know, his place in history is significant, in particular when it comes to what's happening right now.
What does he mean by my legacy is my family? I mean, I know his daughter's accomplished, yes. But that's not the question. The legacy is
right.
Your body of work as a legislator. We can answer that for him. It's this mess. That's your legacy. And that's also the Blagojevich legacy and the, you know, pick any of the other governors you want. It's their legacy, too. But, boy, if you had to pin it on somebody, I think he has to share a lot of the blame.
Well, and you know, I've talked to a lot of people about what happened, you know, when Governor Edgar was in office and they started raiding the pension funds in order to pay off bills and not raise income taxes, right? I've talked to legislators who were there then, have retired, and they said they used the pensions like a credit card, not understanding the terms of borrowing. And that was terrifying for me, that they just did it. And a lot of them did it because they wanted to get back in office. They didn't want to have the raising of an income tax hung around their necks, right? So that puts the pressure on raising property taxes. If we don't raise income taxes, it's got to go somewhere.
I wonder what the strategy was on that. Was it that the economy will be robust enough that we'll be able to pay it back? Let's just take this money rather than raise taxes?
That seems to have been the assumption in the 80s and in the 2000s because, you know, that was something that slammed us hard was the housing crisis of 2008 and the entire stock. You know, that hit Illinois particularly. I mean, it hit everybody hard, but we've struggled to come back from that on top of everything else.
Well, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? I mean, how many of us were buying houses thinking that I'll be able to resell it for a profit? Oops, now I'm upside down or my job's going to get better and they'll get me into this house at a low rate and I'll be able to pay for it. But everybody that gambled like that, so many people lost. I could see individuals making that kind of mistake, but I'd hate to think that our public officials would routinely make that mistake with our money. And that seems to be what's been happening.
Yeah, I think indeed it has. And I want to say that there have been a lot of legislators that I've watched who are really battling and fighting the good fight for their constituents, regardless of what side of the aisle they're on. And they're really – and they are frustrated. You can see it. I mean, and they stand their ground, you know, whether it's Representative Anderson or Kifowit or Representative Martwick or Senator. You know, a lot of senators are – they're frustrated because they had this done. They finished a budget back in May, and this is what we're still working on. So it's a remarkable time in our history, and I know that people are worried and angry. People talk about voting them all out. My question is always, you know, where is everybody when it comes time to vote? You know, when we chose this governor in the primaries, only 16% of registered voters showed up at the primaries, which means only 3-5% of the state of Illinois chose him as the candidate for the Republican ticket as governor.
Okay, but that's putting it on the governor then.
No, that's putting it on people not showing up. But we have to pay attention to these things. Local government is important. You know, your state government is important. Know who your legislators are. Stop by their office. You know, really meet them. Make them know your story. Let them know where you're coming from and why it's important to represent you. Why? What they're there for. They're your public servants. They answer to you.
Our bewildered Patty Vasquez is hiding. She's in a pop-up tent in Elkhart, Illinois, and so you're going to go back to Springfield tomorrow, did you say, or the 5th?
Yes, well, tomorrow. We'll be rolling the fan van and the Skokie 4th of July parade at noon, and then I'm immediately driving down here for the 4:30 session.
Hey, before I let you go, Patty, just take a quick question or comment with me here. Ralph wanted to jump in on the conversation, and I don't want to hang up on you. Please. So first, let me lock you in. I think I got you locked in.
I always have that problem. The button.
Do you do that sometimes, hang up on people and go, oh, I'm sorry, I thought I had you locked in. My bad, but you really intended to hang up on them?
Yep, my favorite is when it's, somebody's on borrowed time, you know?
All right, Ralph, jump in here. You're on WGN. What did you want to say, Ralph?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Well, being an Illinois person my whole life, the Democrats and Madigan have been in control of this state for 40 years. So I don't think you could blame Rauner for 1 minute, because they don't want to play ball and they don't want to compromise with Rauner. And for 40 years, Madigan has failed to pay into the teachers' fund. Teachers contribute. I'm a retired teacher. We contribute to TRS fund. The TRS fund is solvent. And for 40 years, Madigan has failed to pay into that fund. And we have never had a balanced budget. So, and the Democrats do whatever Madigan tells them to do. Because if they don't, he takes committee work away from them and he punishes them. I'll hang up and listen.
I hear the frustration in Ralph's voice, and I think he's right to be frustrated. I mean, there have been, in that 40 years, you know, Governor Edgar gave an interview saying that, you know, the speaker doesn't have the power in the situation, meaning that when Governor Edgar was in office, you know, that wasn't Speaker Madigan running the state. It was a compromise in many ways. But, yes, they were both responsible, both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, for raiding the teachers' pensions and our public workers' pensions.
Boy, I want to go back. I want to go back to when that started and just say, nope, 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 don't do it. It's too easy. You can't bank on that. You can't gamble with that. That's wrong. Don't do it. It's like whenever they say, here's a temporary income tax hike, and it's only going to be for 4 years. We're going to just balance the budget, or we're going to build better bridges. Sure. We're just going to increase it for 4 years, and then it will automatically go back. But they can change that, and once they're used to the higher tax rate, they make it permanent. That happens all the time.
And we did have a temporary tax hike that expired in 2015, and it wasn't renewed. That was shortly after Governor Rauner took office, and immediately that's part of what caused the first $4 billion shortfall in our budget, was not having that tax hike and counting on the restructuring of the pensions, because the Supreme Court of Illinois ruled it unconstitutional.
So Inez is on a line, and she was one of the people that actually testified at the budget hearings. And I presume her story is a little bit about, here's what happens when you people don't do your work. Inez, stay there. I'm going to come to you in a minute. Patty, do you have one more minute on the line?
Of course. I have all the time for you. I'm just sitting in front of the Wild Hair Cafe in Elkhart, Illinois.
Stay right there, Patty. Hold on a second. It's 2:51. This is GN. Patty Vasquez is on a phone line, speaking of current events and politics in a way. This is the state kind. She's just back from Springfield, or on her way back, and then she's going to head back down again for this is the special session, right, Patty?
Yes, it is.
And how long does that go?
I don't know how special it is. It doesn't feel very special. Go ahead. What was that?
We need a new phrase to describe these extra days of work down there.
Oh, it's emergency. It's an emergency session. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's a catastrophe session. I don't know what to. There's got to be other titles.
Inez is on a line. And Inez, thanks for holding. You're on WGN. What did you want to say?
Hi, thanks for having me. So my name is Inez Kotleshan. I'm the CEO of Guardian Angel Community Services in Joliet. We're actually the eldest nonprofit in Will County, about 119 years, but I've been there for almost 18 years. And I actually had the honor of testifying before the Illinois General Assembly's House Appropriations Services Committee just a little while ago about the budget impasse. And so it is interesting to listen to, you know, what's going on and how it's impacting folks. And so I'm calling in for a number of reasons, of course.
State funded, right?
The majority of our funding does come from the state. Yes, we're a private organization. We have 7 different programs, but some of our largest serve thousands of survivors of domestic and sexual violence every year.
What's your budget? So how much money do you spend each year?
About between $3 and $4 million.
And is this, how is the state funding you or financing you now? Are they current or are they delinquent?
Well, about 80% of our funding comes from the state, and while it's pretty typical for them to be behind, this is something I've never seen in my career in terms of our emergency shelter has not been paid in almost a year. So
I'm sorry, Ines, I keep cutting you off here, but I have to understand this. What do you mean they haven't been paid? The people that work there have not been getting paychecks?
No. Yes, we're paying them, but we have not been paid by the state. Because we were not included in the stopgap budget.
Okay, but then how do you get money to pay them?
Right, so that's the question of the hour, right? Lots of folks are having to close their doors who are in similar situations or take out lines of credit. You know, we've been fortunate that we've had our wonderful donors, and we are a United Way agency as well, and in terms of what we've saved up over the years, but that also will be depleting at some point, and at some point, you know, you're going to have to make some more difficult decisions. Certainly, we've had to cut some services as well in the area of our Rape Crisis Center in particular, and putting folks on waiting lists, and it's just unimaginable. And so I'm an equal opportunity advocate. I have wonderful working relationships with Democrats and Republicans. I've sat on both sides of the aisle on our advisory committees on both sides, because that's what you have to do. So,
but here's my question, Ines, and I'll pose it to Patty first. Do you talk to them like this when you talk to these legislators? Do you say?
I
wonder what's their response when they know there's the Enises of the world out there.
Yes, well, thank you. You know, I had in-person conversations with both Speaker Madigan, actually, and the governor in the.
Oh, pardon me. Hold on a second, Patty. I put you on hold by accident. Patty, keep going.
I'm not talking. That was Ines talking.
Oh, that was Ines talking. All right, well, hold on a second. Ines, I'll come back to you. But, Patty, I was speaking to you specifically about that. How do you respond to that?
It is. It's so frustrating and heartbreaking. And, I mean, like, and Ines will tell you that they nod. They you know, they listen to them. They'll sometimes take notes. And then, I mean, they'll tell them that their hands are tied or, you know, we're doing our best. And, I mean, after, it's the kind of thing where – I mean, they really do parade a lot of people through, and I don't mean that like to be callous about it, but they want that information. They want to gather it. But at the same time, for 3 years now, I've watched these hearings, including people I know who have children with disabilities who they've had to make the tough decision to put their children in group homes because they couldn't take care of them at home. And this is happening all over the state in ways I don't know if we'll ever be able to measure how many people have suffered and died as a result of what's happened over the last 3 years.
All right. Well, you know, keep doing what you do. We'll maybe talk to you later in the week. I'll let you go, Patty. I appreciate your extra time with us this afternoon.
Thank you. Happy 4th of July, John.
Yeah, have a good 4th of July. All of this notwithstanding. And Ines, thank you, too, for kind of calling in and giving us your perspective on that. We're out of time here, but I appreciate both of you sharing some of your thoughts there. And we'll follow that here. By the way, I'm working tomorrow. We'll do a 4th of July type show with some barbecue ideas. We'll continue to follow the news as well, but it won't all be like this. Okay, and now I'm back. All of that for that. Brian, I'm really late here, but why don't you get us started and give us the headline. What is the best thing you're going to talk about on your show today?
Well, I don't know if it's the best thing, but the most important, Rick Pearson will be here at 3:30. We'll talk about the budget. And then a lot of other things that won't be quite as demoralizing, hopefully.
Good news.
Yes.